Joe Doherty joins me in studio now. Joe, thanks so much for coming in and chatting with us.
No bother at all, Greg. Thank you.
Now, you had a sick child, Matthew. I think it's every parent's worst nightmare. I think that's fair to say, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Like, Matthew's been attending Crumlin Hospital now 9 years past in December. He was diagnosed just before Christmas. And he was transferred to Crumlin. It all happened in a blur. You know, and you didn't know what to expect. And, and as you say, it's just every parent's worst nightmare.
And there's no preparing for that?
No, no.
You don't know.
No.
You're going down, what do I do? Where do I go? Who do I see? Where do I get information? Can someone tell me something? It's all that kind of a...
Well, obviously, when you go to hospital first, their first priority is the sick child.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You're the parent. To a certain extent, you're left standing there wondering, but they're very good in Crumlin. I think it's more the fact that it's to do with children. They're more, they explain to you what's happening. And, you know, the night Matthew was transferred, my wife went up and I went up the following morning at 6 o'clock. And thinking back to that day, that going down that dark corridor in Crumlin, they tell you, and anybody's been to Crumlin will know these directions. They tell you at reception, go down past the fish tank, turn left, and go up in the lift. Mm. That's the instruction everybody gets. And I remember going down that morning, I'd been speaking to my wife prior to it. I didn't know what to expect or, you know, when I got there. But thankfully, 9 years on, we're getting there.
Matthew's 10 now.
Matthew will be 10 in February.
And he has a rare blood disease, currently waiting for a kidney transplant, but he's 10 and we don't want to embarrass him too much, so we'll not focus too much on Matthew. But I'm sure, you know, in a lot of situations, we get our strength from children because it's astonishing how they are adaptable, how brave they are, how it's them sometimes that do the supporting.
Yes. Well, one of the doctors told us in Crumlin that, you know, I said to the doctor one time, I wonder, does he realise how sick he is?
Mm.
And she said, to him, it's not sick, it's normal.
Yeah.
You know, that he had to grow up with it. And there's a little story about, and embarrass my niece now as well, but Matthew has a central line in, which is very handy for drawing blood, and he receives his treatment through it. But my niece, she was getting changed in my mother's house one day, and she had to take off her T-shirt, and Matthew said to my mother, he said, where's Rachel's tube?
Yeah.
He thought every child
had
a tube under their arm.
Amazing.
He didn't know that.
That's it's just been with him.
You know, to him, it's just normal.
Excellent. It's just excellent the way they cope. Right, we'll not talk about the other aspects of it, if that's right. I don't think there's no need. I want to talk about Ronald McDonald House.
Yes.
How soon after you knew that you'd be heading down there and it'd be for a period of time did you come into contact with the Ronald McDonald House?
Well, firstly, Matthew was admitted before Christmas and he was in for 11 days and he was let home on New Year's Eve. And then in the middle of January, he got sick again and he was rushed back up to Crumlin. And I think about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we got into... Obviously, the Ronald McDonald House, there's a waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only available to people who are, you know, a certain distance outside of Dublin. You know, they make that quite clear. That if you're from Dublin and there was an empty room, obviously you would get it. But they make the priority for families that have to travel long distances. And I think it was about 3 weeks and we had our name on the waiting list and we got the call. And we went over and we moved over and we couldn't believe how different it was.
Mm.
You know, parents' accommodation is a great facility to have in the hospital.
Because the alternative would be maybe staying at a local lodge or a hotel or
B&B.
B&B
or hotel, yeah.
And, you know, you're going to be down there for some time.
Yeah.
That's fine for a weekend away, lovely. But in an already very difficult situation, that would be an extra layer that would be very hard to deal with.
Well, obviously the financial side would be difficult, but... You probably wouldn't get anywhere that was 2 minute walk from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You went out of one door, a minute and a half walk, you were going in of another door. And it was just, you were in an environment.
And you knew you were close to Matthew.
Yes.
Which is really...
You were 2-3 minutes away. No matter what time of the day it was, you could be there. But you were in an environment with other people who were going through the same thing. And it was like a support mechanism too, because you were at the start of your journey. There were other people nearing the end of their journey and there were people who could give you advice. And obviously there were people who had sad outcomes and you're exposed to that as well. But, you know, thankfully, I was talking to Sean back after the Crumlin program aired and it was just something psychological about actually going outside of the hospital and hearing the hospital door close behind you You were still on the hospital grounds. You were a couple of minutes away, but you weren't in the hospital. It was a break. It was like a mental break from the hospital environment.
And when you went in there, and you were one of the new people, and there were people that had been there for a while, and they were supporting you. I presume you became that man then.
Yes.
A bit further down the road, when you saw a new family coming in, and you're right, I know what.
Yeah.
Well, I know exactly where they are in their journey.
The staff in the Ronald McDonald House would bring new people in, and if you were in about the kitchen or the sitting room, they would introduce the new people to you, and they would say to them, because the staff weren't there 24 hours a day, they would say, if you need anything, just ask.
Mm.
You know, and that's the way we learned, and people tell you where was the best shop to go to, what was the best takeaway to get something to eat at night, you know what, and you just generally found your way around after that. But
what are the facilities like?
Well, to me, it was like a hotel room.
Yeah.
It was like a good 3-4-star hotel room. So two double beds, you had your own private bathroom, and then downstairs they had kitchens, and every kitchen had a fridge, and inside that fridge was a cage allocated to each room. You could have your own food, you had access to cookers, it was just like a self-catering apartment, basically.
But not stuff you would get in a hotel or a lodge generally down there, so that was the extra level of it. And how is it supported? I mean, it provides a fantastic service, and we hear about it all the time, but I mean, is it run by the hospital? Is it run by...
It's run by fundraising.
Really? Literally, yep. Fundraising?
Every penny they spend, they raise. If you're next time you're in McDonald's, you'll see the little glass jar sitting on the counter. All the money from all those jars in the Ronald McDonald's, that goes to the upkeep of the Ronald McDonald House.
Amazing.
Yep, it's totally funded by volunteers and by donations.
And provide such an amazing service. Crumlin's Children's Hospital, it's probably not going to be used forever now, is it? Because there's talk of relocating, amalgamating hospitals to a new site. What stage is that process at now at the moment, Jonathan? Joe, I beg your pardon.
Well, they have the plans drawn up. They're available for anybody who wants to see them online. And I think they've actually started on the process of building a new hospital at the site of St. James's, which to for myself and anybody else coming from outside of the country is not the greatest place in the world. You know, it's easy to get to Dublin. It's getting into Dublin that can be the trouble.
Mm.
You know, Crumlin, you have to go in through the Red Cow. If you're going to Temple Street, you have to go in past Croke Park. You know, I think that the new Children's Hospital should be located on a greenfield site somewhere out along the M50 or just as you come off.
And it makes perfect sense, because this debate gets muddied in that I think everyone agrees, get all the experts into the one place, you know, then you've best outcomes, you've best care. If you need referring, you're not going from one hospital to another. No. It's all, people agree on that. What this comes down to, and anyone hates to be negative when they're talking about Children's Hospital, but it is location. If you're outside Dublin, St. James's, the site there is a nightmare.
It is, and it's only going to get worse. What with you hear stories, there's talk they're going to have to relocate a graveyard to build this new hospital. I just don't think it's feasible. The services at St. James at the moment are going to suffer in the interim while they're doing all this. So I think they should pick a nice greenfield site somewhere out. You're still in Dublin, but you can do what you want. You can. You know,
St. James is going to suit some people, you know, and let's face it, you know, there is a good swathe of the population is in Dublin, but this is a national hospital. And the thing you would have hoped would have been what's best for the nation.
Yes. I personally now, as I said, getting to Dublin's the easy part. You could be in Dublin at 8 o'clock coming on to the M50. You'd be lucky to be at Our Lady's Hospital at 9:30, you know, and usually Matthew's appointment for 9:30 in the morning, so you have to leave pretty early. And if there happened to be an accident along the M50 or the M1, you're...
And you don't want to waste a trip. No, you know, I mean, it's a long way from here to there. Ronald McDonald has... We kicked off talking about that. People should support it, there's no doubt about
indeed,
it.
Yes.
Because God forbid when you might need it.
That's it. Well, I remember back 20 years ago, more even, we used to get our heads shaved every year for Our Lady's Hospital in Crumlin, not knowing what it was, what it did. Mm. You know, and all those years we did that. And now I'm just glad we've given something back and we'll do again.
Excellent. It's astonishing, actually.
It is worthwhile, the way you put that. It is a worthwhile cause.
Listen, Joe, you'll pass on my best regards to the rest of them.
I will indeed.
And Matthew.
I will indeed.
And he's on a list now, isn't he?
He's currently awaiting a kidney transplant. And to anyone who's reading the papers in the last week or so, organ donation is down big time in the last 2 years. So just like to encourage everybody to pick up their card and tick the box.
Would you be in favour of an opt-out system?
I would indeed, yes.
I would?
Yes.
You know,
most countries, it's you're not given a choice.
Yeah.
If you don't want to be an organ donor, you have to make the conscious decision to not be.
Yeah.
So I think Wales have introduced it. So I think
it covers all bases. If you have an issue with it, opt out. And that's fine, and it's perfectly up to you.
Yes.
And there are families that, you know, in the worst situations, they want people. You know where I'm going with that, but have a system whereby you opt out, and then people like Matthew, instead of waiting this long, would be waiting much less amount of time. As I say, pass on our best wishes to 10 years of age.
I will do.
I've won about that age myself.
Yeah. Well, he's not 10 until February now, so it's still single digits yet.
Very good. When he hits 10, you might feel a bit older yourself.
Probably, yeah.
Listen, thanks so much, Joe, for giving us an insight into that, because, as you said before, you were aware of it, but you weren't aware of what it'd done or what they were doing, and it's great that you're educating us. You know, someone like myself who has never been down there,
it's a real experience. And to anyone who's going to grumble about something sillier than today, they should think about all the parents who are in Crumlin at the minute with sick children. Their worries are going to be minuscule compared to that.
And when we as adults sort of think that we're hard done by, look how children react in difficult situations and the bravery they have.
Well, you always think it'll never happen to me, you know, until it does, and then.
All right, Joe, listen, thanks for the insight. And as I say, best wishes to everyone, particularly Matthew.
Thank you very much.
And we'll chat to you again, hopefully. I've got three fantastic guests in with me. Seamus Maguire. There's an evening with Seamus coming up, which we'll talk about very shortly. We also have Martin McGinley and Ted Ponsonby in studio. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No problem.
Very good. Now, who is going to take on the responsibility of telling me about an evening with Seamus Maguire? Yourself, Seamus, or Martin?
I think there can only be one person.
So tell us what the plan is. It's part of Letterkenny Trad Week, which is a really important event, isn't it?
Well, it's the opening concert of the Trad Week. And a few months ago, Patricia McBride and Sean Hannigan asked me if I would, you know, be prepared to go along with their idea, which was to have an evening with myself and the two bands which I play in, the West Ocean String Quartet and Buttons and Bows. And my first reaction was, I'm not so sure, because it would be quite a bit of pressure, you know, to be the focus of the evening.
Yeah.
But when I thought about it, and I thought about getting my two bands together and for the first time maybe performing together, I thought this is a great chance. And then when I heard that the young band Quirim, the young local musicians, would be involved, and the Ball Martin McGinley here, we'd have a few tunes with him too and a bit of crack, so I thought, yeah, let's go with it. So that's what's happening tonight.
So now you have to take the responsibility of the young musicians looking up to you.
And
you're taking that on well. Just generally about traditional music, in the Irish music scene, there's a lot of sort of mixtures of genres going on. What do you feel about, you know, maybe traditional music being introduced or maybe married with soft rock or other areas? Is that to be welcomed, or are you purists? I'll let you answer that one, Martin.
Well, I'll give the initial answer anyway, but you've got a man here who, with the West Ocean String Quartet, has married traditional music and classical music. And
but those genres maybe sit slightly easier together. I'm kind of, you know what I mean? I don't know. I'm not being snobbish about the music, but, you know, a lot of it's sort of in with very, you know, contemporary kind of music.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of young people now who are doing traditional music in universities, and it's a sort of a hot, like places like Limerick and Cork are hothouses, and they're mixing with other musicians, and the result is they've got a bit of time in their hands, they're studying music, and they're sitting down together, and they're working out, you know, how to fuse trad with various other genres. But I think that what's needed in that is that you need somebody who's comfortable in both genres they're trying to do. Like Seamus's case,
yes,
traditional music and classical music, you know, he's perfectly comfortable in both.
It's not forced.
No, but where you get a problem is when traditional music musicians try to play jazz or vice versa, and they're not comfortable in jazz and they're trying to ham it. Mm. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So if you've got somebody who's comfortable in two genres, they can fuse them together. That's what's happening.
Yeah, and the Letterkenny Trad Week, how important do you see those type of events to I mean, we get to hear fantastic experienced musicians, but it also
I think it's very good.
Gives a platform for those coming through.
Yeah, it's really good. It's good encouragement for young people. And there are lots of young people around who are interested in traditional music. And it's a good opportunity for them to hear musicians from other parts of the world. Mm. You know, it actually is timed very well because the Letterkenny Trad Week is just before Glasgow Celtic Connections. And a lot of musicians from all over the world come to that festival. So Donegal isn't too far from Glasgow.
Tap into that
so
talent
the geography
pool.
Yeah. Such that they can tap into it.
Excellent.
It's very good for the interest in traditional music locally, I think, to have this festival. And I think that Patricia and Sean are to be complimented on it.
Mm. The Regional Cultural Centre, a nice venue too.
Well, tonight's concert is actually in the Greenhill. Mm-hmm. And
which is also a beautiful venue as well. I mean, fantastic acoustics,
and,
I hear.
I think we're going to have a big crowd here tonight, which is a proper order for Seamus. He's a fantastic musician. Yeah. Buttons and Bows have just won the Best Traditional Album of the Year for the Return of Spring, which is their... they're sort of doing a... I don't know, Rolling Stones on it. They're back on the road again after a break. And then the West Ocean String Quartet won Trad Album of the Year in 2014. So you've got two of the groups who've put out the best albums in traditional music over the past 3 years, sharing a stage together for the very
uniquely,
first time.
Yeah.
First time ever. It's going to be a great night.
And is there are there any tickets available, Martin?
Well, there may be a few. It's just a matter of...
Normally there can be a few... thereabouts. Give them a ring and just book your spot, because it's not once in a lifetime, it's once on a very rare occasion, but it's a first in a lifetime with the amalgamation of both of your bands.
It's exciting. A bit of music history tonight, I hope. Yeah.
Right, well, a bit of music history now, because this is the first time all four of us have been in the One Radio studio.
That's right.
I will not be playing anything.
You can hum
and ruin it. Are you serious?
Have you got spoons?
You've probably got a boron. I know you've got a boron under that desk.
Oh no, that's not a baron. Right, we have Martin McGinley in studio with us, as well as Ted Ponsonby, and of course to the legendary Seamus Maguire, all legends. And what I'm going to hear first, Martin, if you've decided yet?
Yeah, we're going to play a couple of jigs, and Seamus has the names of them. Well, there's a good story.
Go on.
Seamus was in Costa, and I went over to talk to him one morning, and he said, we were just chatting generally, and he says, I'm looking for tunes for our next Buttons and Bows album. So I was just happened to be listening to your recording of a Donegal fiddle player, Mick Doherty, who'd be a nephew of John Doherty and Mickey Doherty. And he had lived most of his life in Australia. He hadn't been heard of for decades. Suddenly this album came out from Australia, Donegal music and Donegal fiddle music.
Wow.
And I had just been struck by this jig. So I gave it to Seamus, and there it is on the album.
Super.
So it's part of this success story that is the latest Buttons of OCD, a Donegal tune.
And what a way to end up on an album. Starts here, over to Australia, back here, right around the world.
You hear a lot of that about, you know, music going to America and back. Yeah. This is one of the first times that, you know, an example of Irish music going to Australia and back has...
kind of reflective of where we are too, I suppose, as a nation, as a world.
Yeah.
Take it away, guys.
Okay. Thank you.
what an absolute treat. Now, can you imagine if we had the heating on? Nobody's joking. I know it was a little bit chilly in the green room as we were preparing. Absolutely lovely. And there's more. Are you going to do another one for us?
Well, I was wondering if Seamus might do a lovely slow tune, which his brother Manus composed. Fort Dunree, which is obvious, an Anishona's. Most people in Donegal will know.
That'd be a real treat if you wouldn't mind, Seamus.
And it's made, it's played in the sessions, particularly in Anishona, but increasingly around the county and the country. A lovely tune, so it'd be lovely to hear that.
Okay. It's always a pleasure to go into a session in Donegal and hear this tune composed by my young brother, played by trad musicians. So it's an honour to hear it. So we'll have a go at that, will we, Ted?
Yeah.
It's called Fort Dunree, and it's from the new album.
Beautiful. Now, that is something else. Absolutely beautiful. Thank you for that treat, Seamus. I do appreciate that.
Just, can I mention a couple
I don't think I'm going to be able to stop you doing it, Martin, so I think you should just batter on there.
But I want to say hello to my partner, Violet, and her mum, Anna, who will be listening in the High Cairn and Remelton. And I also want to remember, because today's my birthday, I want to say hello to anybody who's got a birthday today, and to remember Brian Friel, whose birthday was today, 9th of January, and you know, he's a fantastic man, and so we'll remember him today as well.
And he'll be remembered for a very, well, eternally.
He absolutely will.
Sing along with this, Seamus Coyle.
I was going to do it.
Happy birthday, Martin. garden, serenaded on Highland Radio live
by Ted Ponsonby and also by Seamus as well, Seamus Maguire. An evening with Seamus Maguire in On Green On tonight. Get onto the box office. If there are tickets left, I would say there's very, very few. And if you don't get hot on it now, you're going to miss out. Tell us about the albums, just Seamus, before I let you go. I know you've got your finger in two pies here, but you, that beautiful piece that you've just played there, what albums are available at the moment, the most recent ones?
Well, that's on our most recent one. It's the Buttons and Bows album, and it's called The Return of Spring. Mm-hmm. And it's the one which, as Martin mentioned, won the Album of the Year award recently.
Yes.
So yeah, that's the one.
And it's going to stand the test of time. That's going to be played in many, 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 many years to come.
Cool.
Thank you so much, Seamus Maguire. I beg your pardon. Thank you very much, Seamus Maguire. Also, Martin McGinley and Ted Ponsonby, superb on the guitar there as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Now, moving on in the programme, Making a Murderer is the Netflix documentary that's taken the world by storm, and the weekend edition has secured an interview with one of the key players in this series. Well, Stephen Avery of Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, was sent to prison for 18 years for a crime he didn't commit, only to be released after a prolonged legal battle. But once he's finally let go, just a few years later, he's thrown into prison again for a different crime that the documentary argues Avery also may not have committed. Jerome Buting, one of Stephen Avery's defence lawyers, has not been very outspoken in the media. Indeed, he's only given one interview to US media, but we've secured a chat with him, and I'm delighted to welcome him to the programme. Jerome Buting, first and foremost, thank you for taking the call. And secondly, are you surprised, or perhaps not surprised at all, at the level of interest this documentary has garnered?
Well, definitely, we did not expect this kind of outpouring of interest all over the world. I mean, we knew it was a very interesting case. We've worked on it, you know, for many years. And it seems to have captured the public's attention for a lot of reasons. I think the injustice that's depicted, the sort of the mystery of, you know, who really did commit this crime, all those things are sort of gripping people.
There must be a level of frustration there, though. The whole world is, it seems, talking about this case, and yet those who many believe are the victim of an injustice are in no better place as a result of that.
Well, that's true, unless ultimately what I believe to be the real killer is charged, found, and prosecuted. You know, then there might be some real closure. But unfortunately, you know, while I feel for the victim's family in this situation, I also represent a man who has now twice been subjected to wrongful conviction, and he's in custody. And so I have to do what I can to try and try and see that he gets justice.
What is his mood now when you speak to him?
Well, I can't, because of attorney-client privilege, I can't really discuss specifics. Mm. But, you know, the irony is he hasn't even seen it. He's not allowed in the prison to see Netflix or, you know, internet streaming. So, and at this point, it's not on DVD, I don't believe. So he really hasn't seen it, but he's certainly aware of it. And his family has been very supportive and, you know, hopeful, I would say.
It shines a very bright light on the judiciary system, particularly in this state, in the US, and what is shown there is not favourable. And we have an initial trial, but there have been subsequent appeals, and still it seems that those decision makers can't see what it seems everybody else can see. That's frustrating, I'm sure.
It is very frustrating, and you know, in particular, the appeals system is, in America, really designed, or at least the effect of it, is to maintain a conviction rather than really see what's just and, you know, reverse. You know, there are cases where that happens, where they can see through the usual legal hurdles, obstacles that we have to get by. But people often think that the know, if you got the wrong jury verdict, that you can overturn it on appeal. And America, that's very difficult, very difficult.
Can you explain to listeners how the two people involved in this can be apparently accused of two very different crimes, or at least aspects of the accusations to be very, very different, yet both have verdicts returned, and yet one can't work in favour of the other, if you understand the question, or how I phrased it?
I think I understand. If you're talking about how the way the prosecutor in his closing argument, in my case, the Stephen Avery case, was saying that, you know, one person killed Teresa Halbach. This man, and he was focusing really just on him. He did not bring in Brendan Dassey to our trial, which we were prepared for, and I think which, frankly, would have been better for us, because then the jury would have seen. They already heard a version of what this young man's so-called confession was, and it didn't come in a trial, but it was in their knowledge base, because there was so much pretrial publicity about it. But then to prosecute the 16-year-old boy and change your theory of how the crime was committed, to me, I know that has disturbed a lot of people, and it's disturbing to me.
As it relates to you, and I presume you want to keep the focus on Mr. Avery, but I mean, this has taken up a considerable part of your life, and I'm sure your family's life. Do you find it difficult to be able to take a step back from this case to exist outside of it, if you understand?
Well, you know, the trial itself was 8 years ago, and I have to say that, you know, for at least six months before the trial, I didn't work on any of my other cases. It was all Mr. Avery's case. And then we had a six-week trial. And at the end of that, I did have a very difficult time disengaging, stepping back into my practice, because I really felt that an injustice had occurred. You know, you second-guess yourself. You know, maybe we should have done this. Maybe we should have done that. Would it have mattered? And it is disturbing. And it's, you know, I know that people have written to me all over the world about how they can't sleep after watching this documentary. And, you know, I certainly felt the same way after we lost the trial. It took me longer than any other case I've had to be able to disengage and try and get back to my real life.
One of the things I noticed watching this documentary and others such as The Stairway is the difference in how they are reported in America, say, compared to in Ireland, hearing that journalists, they say they decimate the information, they draw conclusions of even innocent or guilt, even in the opening days of a trial. Does that in any way, do you believe, affect the outcome of it, or is it just par for the course now?
Well, I think it definitely affected my case and Brendan's case because of so much pretrial publicity that was improper and really based on this story that the prosecutor gave that was a horrible story. It would, you know, curl your hair, anybody who heard it. And yet it was not a true story. It was not what happened. And they knew that because there was no physical evidence to support it. But by what happened with the media is that version comes out and that becomes the gospel truth for another 8 months, where every time you turn on the TV, Mr. Avery is portrayed as this monster who did this horrible thing. It was not until the trial began that, because we were not, in America, the defense can't, and really the prosecution is not supposed to either, but you can't hold press conferences before the trial and talk about what your evidence is going to be. And so once the trial began and we started pointing out all of the things or a lot of the things that are in the documentary, the media started saying, well, wait a minute, this is not at all what we thought. But unfortunately, not only the jury pool was already tainted, but public opinion, most of them, you know, stopped following it anyway. It was like, this guy's guilty. There's, you know, not much to it. So what the documentary has done is reached that audience, that public, and a much, much larger audience and really shined a light on the way the system works. And unfortunately, this is not the only case in America where this kind of thing happens.
And Jerome, I won't hold you very much longer. We do appreciate your time. But one has to feel that if this program is going to make a difference, that it would have to be very, very soon while it's very fresh in the public image. You talk of perhaps the actual murderers, you'd see it being apprehended and charged with the crime. I wonder what appetite there is for that within law enforcement. Do you think there is perhaps somebody out there that could come forward with information that could, you know, allow the law to relook at this?
I do. I think that there are people that have information that in that area have been, they're fearful, intimidated, that there will be retaliation if they do. And, you know, I've tried to explain that, you know, that's extremely unlikely now that the public is looking very carefully at law enforcement, that they're, you know, that this would be the last time they could, someone could get away with trying to punish him. But one of the jurors spoke out, said that he really was forced into, actually he or she, it hasn't been identified, but one of the jurors talked about how they felt intimidated and fearful in the jury deliberations. That's not necessarily grounds for a new trial, believe it or not, under American law.
But, you know, it is very interesting because we... I beg your pardon, Jerome. It is very interesting how you say that, because we talk of this, not you, but us viewers, journalists talk about this almost like it is a film now and that these are characters. But at the time, this is a smallish community. Everyone probably knows everybody. And those are perhaps aspects of this that we don't give full consideration to.
You're right. And, you know, I'm hopeful that nevertheless, I mean, some people are already coming forward. We're getting some information that could develop into new leads. We're also getting contacted by, you know, very esteemed scientists from all over the world who are talking about these new techniques that have been developed since the trial, just in the last 8 years, that might also give us grounds for a new trial, because the FBI came up with this test sort of on the fly to determine whether or not there was this chemical preservative, EDTA, in the stain. And we did not have a chance to rebut it because the results were not even turned over to us until the last week of the trial. So that was a very unfair procedure. I know a lot of people are upset about that, too. And I'm hopeful that something will happen soon. You're right. While there is still interest in this, and we're doing what we can, I certainly will be when I get back to my office. I'm on holiday in Rome at the moment, but as you can tell, I'm not able to escape everything.
And we really do appreciate you giving off some of your time to us, and maybe in the future, have you visited Ireland in the past, Jerome? Have you any connection with the country?
I have. Both my wife and my ancestors are from Ireland, and mine are from the north, and hers are from the middle. I can't remember the county right now.
Well, we'll not pin you down on that, Jerome, and we won't take any more of your time. We do really, really appreciate you sparing time from your holiday to chat to us. We hope you enjoy the break, and hope that you what you seek in this case, i.e. progress as it relates to vindicating your client, we hope that's forthcoming for you as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the support of everyone.